I'd be interested to know from the panel how much of our current boom is a direct result of China and the resources sector. And if it's a big proportion, is it going to continue? Don, do you want to go first?
Certainly China and the boom has been a big factor, but let's go back to 1999. In 1999, our economy was travelling well and had been travelling well for 8 years. And do you remember what people were talking about in 1999? Australia was an old economy and no one wanted to be an old economy. And of course now everyone wants to own a dirty coal mine and a dirty iron ore mine. So even when commodity prices were very low then, our economy was tracking well. Obviously what's happened to China and India and the lack of supply response to date was the big factor in that surge in the terms of trade in Rory's graph. I wouldn't try these days to separate the two. Probably, though, China and the international terms of trade are taking over from domestic reforms because the domestic reform process has slowed down. My final comment, though, is I don't think Australian governments are putting enough of the commodity, the peak of the commodity tax receipts into either saving or capital expenditure. I think we've allowed too much of the resources boom to go to simple tax cuts, additional government recurrent spending, and in a few years' time we'll regret that.
Okay, thank you. Either of you want to add anything to that? You agree? Rory?
Oh, I'd say that, sure, the commodity price boom has been a big thing driving growth. We can see that in the stats where Western Australia and Queensland are the above average states. But I think more generally there's a thing called the Great Moderation where since the past two decades or so, right around the Western world, low and stable inflation has been breeding low and stable interest rates, which has bred much more stable and solid growth. And that's the solid growth year after year that's allowed unemployment rates to come down to, you know, whether you're in New Zealand, Australia, Britain, the US, unemployment rates are at levels that policymakers have been trying for two or three decades. And I think that the breaking of the back of inflation in the early 1980s in the US and the early 1990s everywhere else is the single biggest thing that has been behind the sort of the steady growth that's given us low unemployment and you know, high share price and great prosperity.
I just want to have a word.
I must agree with Don Stemmer, though, that insufficient money is being poured into infrastructure. There's no question that the Chinese growth and the Indian growth is going to continue. It's inevitable that it will. And India has got particular designs, rather stupidly, I think, on large growth in manufacturing. But Australia is not prepared for a resources boom, say, 10 or 15 years out. And I think we're going to regret that, that the Howard government is more interested in being a large spending government on the basis that they can keep on being re-elected rather than a far-visioned government that is thinking more clearly about Australia's future.
There's been a lot of talk about carbon trading. Okay, and both locally and internationally. And I guess an interesting question. If carbon trading comes in, and if it's done internationally, what do you think the economic impact could be on the economy over the next 3 to 5 years? Rory, do you want to have a go at that first?
No, thanks. No, I think that's one of the things I know less about, a lot less about than particularly Don. I see him taking a few notes here. I literally don't know very much about it all. Obviously, our energy-intensive sectors would struggle. They wouldn't do as well if they were paying for the externalities, but I'll yield to anyone else.
could I just say that if Labor gets into power anytime soon, bearing in mind that the state Labor governments have got goals of renewable energy by 2010 and are rather keen on some form of carbon tax, that we will get trading in Australia, carbon trading in Australia. And I might say that the US has its own form of carbon trading. It's ridiculous to base this policy on that all the countries, including China and India, are going to suddenly adopt that sort of regime. But if Australia does adopt it by about 2010, then it will have some effect, and the prices of electricity will rise, but that's an inevitable. But I would have thought it'd be a good, very great discipline for that to happen.
When you think about the economy or the share market, you make a distinction between trend and cycle. The long-term trend for shares is probably to go up 8 or 9% a year, or return 8 or 9% a year. Some years are a lot more, some years are a lot less, and that's the cycle. I think when it comes to climate, we also need to make a distinction between trend and cycle. I do worry a lot about climate change as a trend, but I don't like the politicians or the Greens who attribute today's drought to climate change. We have had droughts before huge build-up of emissions. So I think there is a trend we've got to worry about, but it's not the factor that produced the drought here or the hurricanes in New Orleans. I think the real choice for Australia, though, is what does it do to reduce greenhouse gas emissions? And I think the way the debate's going here, we're going to get a lot of talk and a lot of half-baked ideas. I think we need to make a sharp distinction between carbon taxes, which the state governments would love because it's additional tax revenue, and almost certainly it would be spent on recurrent spending and create other imbalances. I have no trouble with Australia setting up a sensible system of emission credits which can be traded, what I think Australia's got to do is set total emission credits which come down very gradually over time. When we are a coal-dependent economy, we've got a huge investment in electricity generation basically from coal, and I think the best policy for Australia would be some kind of, as part of an international review of greenhouse gas emissions, to go to an emission trading regime, but basically starting off with credits provided for all the emissions we make at present and bring it down very gradually. I think that's a sensible thing, but so many people now want a quick response, partly because they believe the last 2 years dry is attributed to climate change. I think we're going to end up with a mishmash of policies, and it'll be bad policies that create problems for business and the economy, not policies to adjust to climate change.
My name is Jim Dimmings. My question to any of the panel is the rise in house prices brought great prosperity to anyone in Sydney, and I think the new underclass in Australia and those that haven't had homes that have been renting. And I wondered to what extent one could attribute the rise in house prices to the lack of capital gain on that. And secondly, I know that from time to time there's a bank chance to disarm with a suggestion that that might be buried, but do we feel that there's the political will in Canberra to tackle that sacred cow?
Well, my good friend, my good old friend, or good young friend, if you like, Jim, there is no question that the lack of a capital gains tax on owner-occupied houses is a big factor, and particularly in the case of the would-be developer who buys a house, does it up, sells it in 2 years, and gets a capital gain, which is actually a far worse element than anything else. No, there is no urge in Canberra for such a tax. To its credit, the US does tax housing on capital gain, but at the same time, the US has indulged in a lot of other practices in housing that may be a lot worse. But there is no urge for that, unfortunately.
I'll be very brief and then I'll hand over to Don. Just on in terms of sort of, it's always been true that the main gap between the well-off and the less well-off has been owning a home. It's just the doubling of home prices, in real home prices in a decade, meant that the gap between the well-off and the less well-off doubled in a decade. By accident, mostly, in that interest rates came down. If you didn't own a home when interest rates halved, you were left behind, and particularly, you know, if you were in that stage of the life cycle, as in young people who weren't ready to own a home yet, you're at school or uni or you hadn't been born yet, that was a thing that you got left behind by accident. But I think the awkward thing for society now is that it's never before mattered as much that you've chosen your parents wisely. Basically, if you want to own a nice house near town, if you don't have parents who own one, your chances of having one are small, to say the least.
Jim, I think your question's a very good one, and I'm cynical about politicians handling climate change well. I'm even more cynical about politicians handling the imbalance of house prices well. The last recent housing price boom we had on the East Coast was remarkable for its strength, particularly at a time of low inflation. And remember what a funny year 2002 was. A lot of people were talking seriously about deflation, and house prices just kept going up. And house prices have gone up too much. If you, from an investor's point of view, you basically, your yield in Sydney is 2.5% if you're lucky, and that's a PE of 40. I think housing is a bit like the Japanese banking system. It only reforms itself through the long passage of time. And I think we've got to have a housing price underperformance for a decade or a decade and a half for a lot of Australians on average or lower than average income to be able to afford housing. And all the things the politicians talk about cut in stamp duty or a little more land, basically house prices went up too much in the boom because of low interest rates and the halving of capital gains tax on investment housing. House prices, when they go up too much, they plateau for a long time. They don't do what shares do when they've gone up too much, which is to fall. And I think we've got a grinding problem, and therefore I think it's a long-lasting problem. The best thing I think governments could do is to encourage more sensible medium-density housing. I mean, cities like Amsterdam and London offer much better choice of medium-density housing than we do, and I think that's social problems with us for a long time, and I think some of the band-aid solutions will in fact create new problems.
Look, could I just add what is a serious element to this discussion, which is that there is a subprime market in Australia. There's been a... if somebody is behind their payments on a house for more than 3 months, then the mortgagee can take possession. And there has been a rapid turnover of houses where the mortgagee has taken possession and then quickly sold them at a profit to housing investors. So the thing is that the Reserve Bank have some very interesting statistics which are much more important than housing affordability, but which are more relating to the ability of house owners with large mortgages, the financial stress involved. And there is quite a lot of financial stress involved. If were interest rates to rise, and that's in the lap of the gods, but were interest rates to rise, there will be a lot of other homeowners who will be in very great difficulty.